This is Radical Love Life, an ongoing series of podcasts and special events where we explore faith outside the boxes. Hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson.
Hey, everybody. It's Kelly, and welcome to Radical Love Live. Mark is conducting a super important business meeting right now, but he will be joining us shortly when he finishes. But in the meantime, that gives me an opportunity to get caught up with our guest today, who I'm super excited to introduce, an old friend of mine who I had the pleasure of going to high school and college with. We haven't seen each other in person in quite a while, but we keep up online. But today, I want to introduce Melanie Hood Wilson. She's the principal consultant at Melanie Hood Wilson & Associates, a longtime educator in the Baltimore area and in Maryland, and now I'm looking at your bio here, so hopefully we can cut that out. Longtime educator in the Baltimore and Maryland area, and now is providing services that are, from the website, quote, designed to teach, enlighten, and change lives. Melanie, welcome to Radical Love Live.
Hi, thank you so much, Kelly. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great. It's great to see you. We were just catching up before the broadcast started about some of our background in the theater.
Yes, and we're part of a very small group of people who are graduates of Baltimore School for the Arts and went on to Sarah Lawrence College, and even smaller than that, graduated Baltimore School for the Arts and for theater. And then went on Sarah Lawrence College to study theater as
Very exclusive club.
I'm happy to say I'm the founding member. I was the first one ever to go from to Sarah Lawrence.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember this, but you actually recruited me. You had gone. You were ahead of me at BSA and went to Sarah Lawrence and came back and gave a little presentation on, like, this is what Sarah Lawrence is like. And I was like, wow, there's like writing and theater and mostly women. Yeah, like, I'm totally in. Yeah,
dude, so that is hilarious because I have not thought about that in probably 30 some years. And as you're saying that, I remember there being this little redheaded boy who seemed to take a lot of interest in what I was saying about Sarah Lawrence. And I'm now suspecting that was you.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe.
Were you
it
a carrot top? Were you a ginger at the time?
My hair has gotten darker and grayer as I get older.
All of us.
Yeah, that was. Yeah.
That is so cool. I'm really happy to hear that. That makes me feel great, because my oldest daughter ended up BSA to Sarah Lawrence, and my younger daughter's best friend. So I'm feeling very feeling very important right now. Thank you so much.
Well, definitely, it set me on the right trajectory, I hope.
Same.
You know, a lot of my my interest now is, you know, although I've had a pretty successful career in advertising as a writer, is in theology. Yes. And not a lot of people knew it at Sarah Lawrence at the time, because I spent a lot of my time in the theater, but I was taking kind of like a stealth theology program in the background. Mm-hmm. I studied hermeneutics with Elfie Raymond and studied the emergence of Christianity with Cameron Afzal, and studied with Frank Randall. And I was just, I kind of kept it on the down low as I was, you know, one of the cool guys in the theater. But it's definitely has impacted my whole life since then.
That's interesting. But also, in terms of keeping it on the down low at Sarah Lawrence, that's kind of what also comes with being a progressive who's also a Christian, is that you often find yourself in these communities where if you, sometimes just saying, you know, I'm a Christian or I believe in the Christian sort of belief system, automatically there are a lot of very negative assumptions. And I'm not one of those people who's like, you know, oh, it's an assault on Christianity or we're under attack. It's not like that. It's just, there are some unfortunate stereotypes that go along right now with Christian, and a lot of those are earned. But yeah, so that struck me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was hard for me, you know, 'cause I really wanted to, you know, I didn't want to, as they say, hide my light under a bushel and say, you know, I'm, you know, I kind of hide it. Like I made it fairly clear what my beliefs were, but there were also, I had to do that kind of, I'm not that kind of Christian because, you know, a lot of the things or a lot of the experiences that I had that that caused my shift from a very evangelical background to a progressive background were meeting lots of different kinds of people, people with different belief systems than me, and going like, oh, wow, you really, you have a very established, thriving belief and you don't have any reason to believe what I believe. And I respect that.
Yeah.
Or people who didn't believe it at all. And I understood their reasoning and, you know, hanging out with people who are of all kinds of different sexual orientation and gender identities and going like, these are lovely people and created in the image of God.
Exactly.
You know,
created in the image of God. I totally feel you. When I first went on Facebook, which was a billion years ago, probably 2000 and something, you know, in the aughts. And they wanted, you know, they had a space for, you know, your religion. I don't even know if that's still there. And mine was Christian, but not that kind of Christian is exactly what I wrote. Because, because of exactly what you just described. But when I was at Sarah Lawrence, I was still in my very much like my screw Christianity kind of stage, because my upbringing was in the Baptist church. And a black Baptist church, which is different than, you know, your typical like Southern Baptist church or whatever. But still, there's a heavy emphasis in my faith community. There's a heavy emphasis on reading the Bible and learning, like memorizing verbatim, learning the Bible, but then always following somebody else's very strict interpretation of it. I was that kid who it's like, okay, I've read this and I have questions. And that's not really welcome. And so I had enough of those experiences as a young person, as a youth, you know, as an adolescent, that I was just done with Christianity, just done. And in college, I was really exploring the idea of converting to Judaism. And part of that was because I liked the fact that there's an encouragement to continue to think and explore and to dwell and on issues and question, you know, those things that you think are true and challenge ideas. That's, I feel like, what we all should be doing. But in my Christian upbringing, in the faith tradition that I come from, that's wrong, because if you don't accept the doctrine exactly as it is without questioning, then you're not accepting the word of God and you're not a good Christian. And that's what I was always told. And God gave me a brain for and I am a questioner. I question things. I think it's good to challenge oneself. So I flirted with the idea of converting to Judaism for a while when I was in my college years. And somehow in my late 20s, I ended up coming back to Christianity, which was again back to the Black Baptist church, which I stayed with for a few years when my daughter, my youngest daughter, was a small child. I think up at probably around 2000 or so. I couldn't do it anymore because it just didn't align with my worldviews. I'm not capable of sitting in a church and listening to someone preach against, you know, LGBTQ rights. I can't sit and listen to someone preach against a woman's right to do what she wants to or needs to with her own body. I can't do that. I did end up in the aughts finding the United Church of Christ, and I joined a really great progressive UCC church that was around the corner from my house here in Baltimore. It was a fantastic faith community. But unfortunately, what I see in too many progressive churches is what happened to us, which was that, you know, the folks who saw the world the way we did didn't want anything to do with a Christian church. And the people who seemed to be looking for churches were not looking for what we were offering as a faith community, which was this very, you know, this version of Christianity that is based specifically on Jesus's words and is open and including inclusive or, you know, open and accepting, I think, is the term that used to be used back then. I don't know if that's still the word that's used in theology, but, you know, that, yes, we want people who are from the LGBTQ plus communities in our church. And yes, we want people who are questioning. You don't have to be, you know, I'm 100% sold on Jesus to be a part of our church. You know, you just need to be a person who is open to these ideas that we're talking about and is able to be a part of a community. And social justice was a big part of that. And I fell in love with UCC, but that community died for financial reasons, you know, because we just didn't have enough people to be able to keep the doors open, and broke my heart. And it's sort of like a marriage. I feel almost like in a faith way, in a spiritual way, like a widow who's just never been ready to remarry.
Does that mean then you're not formally part of a faith community right
now?
Not
currently, no. No.
No. It's interesting that we were just talking on Facebook the other day about this this kind of split between the idea of religion and spirituality, yes, which is something that comes up on this show quite a bit, particularly because there's a growing population in the United States of people who identify as spiritual but not religious, and often. Yeah. Because of a lot of the stigma and, you know, a lot of the kind of the bad vibes about a lot of organized religious organizations that are excluding people or doing crazy stuff with money or aligning themselves politically in some, you know, really un-Christ-like ways. Yeah. Do you find that your spirituality is still active and thriving even outside of a formal community?
100%. So it's interesting. I feel like I get, when I was part of a faith community, for me, it wasn't really about, I don't feel like it had as much a bearing on my spirituality as it was wonderful to fellowship with other people who were like-minded. Mm-hmm. You know, it was that fellowship component I miss. I don't feel like I'm any less committed to my relationship with God than I was then. My relationship with God has changed. I find that instead of, and I'm not trying to say the one is better than the other or that you can't do both, but I, you know, when I was attending a faith community, that was kind of where I sat my spiritual time, I guess. Now I think about these things a lot. And also it may be age, you know, I'm in my 50s now. I'm, you know, I make, you know, you start wanting to make sense of things in a different way. Maybe it's that, but I spend a lot more time now than I ever have thinking about God, thinking about my relationship with God, thinking about what I believe and what I don't believe. And just, and honestly, and that's probably another reason that I haven't sought a new faith community, is that my spirituality is based on kind of a weaving together of these different elements. And, you know, there's a whole lot of Jesus in there. And then there's like other things that are just sort of my making sense of the world and deciding which parts of what's in the book I think are real and correct and appropriate to my life. And which parts I think are not, to be quite honest. And of course, knowing what we know, that there were so many books that were eliminated. You know, if I had the wealth of being able to read every gospel, every book that the King James, you know, crew did not include, and then you're a theologian. Theologist. I am not. So maybe that's the wrong telling of the history. But I mean, I was in my 20s when I learned about how much isn't in our Bibles. And that began sort of a journey for me. That might have actually been when I almost started to make my way back to the Christian church, because all of a sudden it started to make more sense to me that there's more to this picture than I'd ever been provided, and more to this picture than probably most of us have been provided. And so, you know, that actually led me back towards the church. And I think that actually began when I read, The Origin of Satan by Elaine Pagels. Is that, I don't know if that's the name of the book. It was an Elaine Pagels book back in the 1990s, I think it was called The Origin of Satan. And it was, because as a good Baptist girl, I just always believed that Satan was always there. Of course, you can't have God without a devil. And, you know, in the book, she talks about the evolution of this idea of Satan, and that in the original writings, religious writings in Judaism, that character of a devil, that devil, didn't really exist. And I think there are even ways of reading definitely the story of Jesus. I mean, if you look at it through a modern psychological lens, that enemy who's sitting in the garden with him, tempting him, I mean, doesn't that exist in all of us?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Not to be too flippant about it, but isn't that what RuPaul calls your inner saboteur? These are the reasons that I definitely consider myself more spiritual than religious, because most religious Christians would cast me out of the saying that I don't believe there's a Satan. I believe there's a God, but I don't believe there's a devil. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I don't believe necessarily in heaven or hell or an afterlife, unless there is one for everyone, because it has occurred to me in recent years that part of why we are in this ecological crisis that we're in is that all major religions set humans apart from animals and say that, you know, we are created in God's image. Therefore, we are above, we are greater, we are entitled to enjoy the earth in a different way. And we are finding that we're suffering because of that. We are part of an ecosystem, and we mm-hmm. play our own role in this ecosystem the same way a bug does, or the same way that, you know, a rabbit does, or the same way that a deer or a turtle or a fish does. And we're all important to that. And the more I thought about that, the more I started thinking, well, then why is it that I get to go to a heaven when I die? And, you know, the ant that I killed in my kitchen does not. We're both God's beings. We both are part of this larger mm-hmm. ecosystem that God has created, where we all are interdependent on each other. It's a beautiful design. It's divine design. We all are interdependent on each other in this beautiful way. So why is it that I would have privileges that other animals wouldn't? If that makes sense. Do I sound mm-hmm. crazy? Sometimes I feel like I sound a little
nutsy. No, there's some emerging theologies about that are exactly about what you're talking now about, you know, that stem from, you know, you go back to Genesis, that God created creation and it was good and created all these different creatures. In fact, it's kind of weird that when they were looking, you know, that if you read the story of Genesis, which I think is kind of like one of those like just so stories, like, hey, grandpa, how did death enter the world? Let me tell you a story. There was a couple and an apple and, mm-hmm. you know, or a pomegranate or whatever. But there's a weird little passage where they're like, God was looking for a helpmate for Adam and actually considered several of the animals first before creating Eve. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that to me suggests at least that there's some kind of care for these, you know, these other creatures. Mm-hmm. And to your point, we are all interconnected. You know, if all the bees died, we would be in a really, really terrible situation.
Yeah.
You know, if all of our, you know, gut microbiome mm-hmm. dies, we die. You know, we are totally dependent on a lot of different creatures that we're not even necessarily consciously aware of on a daily basis. So I believe that a good, I don't know if good is the right word, but a comprehensive theology does need to include our relationship with creation. And it's not just use it up as much as you can, because the rapture is going to come pretty soon. We're going to leave this, you know, this earth behind. It's that we are the stewards of this creation that we're a part
So no,
You're not crazy.
Thank you very much.
By the way, I did look up the book that you were talking about, it's called The Origin of Satan, How Christians Demonized Jews, Pagans, and Heretics by Elaine Pagels.
That was it. Yep.
You know, to go back to our Sarah Lawrence days, that the devil was actually part of what I guess would be now called my deconstruction. Was I was in a literature class where we were studying Dante's Inferno. And I was the only person, in the whole class who had grown up in a church, which kind of tells you, you know, the progressive liberal the makeup of the class. So people started asking me a lot of questions about the devil. And I actually kind of knew a lot from the theologies that I'd been part of. And, you know, I'd been in a holiness theology and also in a charismatic theology where there's a lot of like demonology and that kind of stuff. But I stayed up one night. I had a Bible. It was actually my had been my grandfather's Bible I took with me to college, and stayed up in the coffee shop one night, like smoking cigarettes and flipping through the Bible, because I wanted to know what the Bible really said. I was like, what are the actual passages? And I found passages about Lucifer. I found passages about an angel that fell from heaven. I found passages about a character named Satan, who was kind of like God's work buddy in Job, where they're like, hey, I'm making a little bet about this guy.
Okay.
And then devils and demons, but they're all really separate, written by very different people in very different circumstances across 5,000 years, and discovered how brilliantly John Milton and Dante pulled all these different legends together and wove them together into this tale that we now kind of take for granted in the Bible.
Yeah.
And I came into the next class because I told them all I was going to do this research. I came into the next class and I'm like, I have to admit, this story is not in the Bible.
There's so
this is something that developed over time.
I'm sorry, a question.
You know, and these characters were different characters. Look, Mark is here jumping right in at exactly the right time.
Hi, Mark. It's nice to meet
you. All right. Well, likewise, Melanie. Likewise. I apologize
for the devil. He'll get that joke when he comes back and listens to the episode.
Oh, wow. Would you guys, you're accusing me of being like, the origin of Satan. That's me. Huh? Yeah, well, some would accuse me of being a heretic.
No, that's not what I'm saying. Just a familiar phrase.
Yes, right. So, all right. Well, I'll hop right in and I'll pick up where you're going. So let's go.
Okay. Yeah. We were just talking about how about like Satan and, you know, some of the mythology that we believe or that some people believe is in Christian tradition is not.
Yeah.
And that when you really look at the words of the Bible and what which books got in and which books didn't get in, that it all, you know, one of the things Melanie talked about earlier was going to a certain church and listening to that certain pastor's interpretation.
Of course.
That as we're continuing to study our spirituality, that we're realizing that it's always based on interpretation, and that ultimately you have to just rely on your own interpretation.
Absolutely. But are we just now becoming, so, you know, a brilliant place for me to jump in, because, you know, you and I have talked about this and I would agree that it is all about interpretation. But if you look back in the history, at least the time that we've all been on the planet in this form, it's only been within the last few years that people have realized that there's not a binary here. Either you drink the Kool-Aid that's being given to you, and you may quibble about it and don't understand it, or you just typically like, yeah, no, I'm not going to participate at all, and I become a spiritual but not religious, right? Because that can happen. There's actually a third way. There's tons of gray in there. It's like anything else. Actually, that's the biggest part of this. And the point I'm trying to get to is it's actually re-engaging ourselves to get to that interpretation, to explore faith outside the boxes, like we do here at Radical Love Line, our love with our tagline. Exactly. Because when we do that, then we become more literate. And ultimately, I think we reclaim our faith in this process as well and figure out what's truth and what's not truth, or what becomes flawed theology because of somebody who told us their opinions and their beliefs based on biblical interpretation. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we were talking about.
Oh, wow.
Melanie was talking about how what she brings with her from her background, but also what she's kind of figured out is and is not. And, you know, where you ultimately have to come down to like, okay, this is what I believe.
Yeah.
Regardless of what an institution tells me to believe.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Did you get a new haircut? You look fantastic.
Oh, thank you. I did actually.
I
so kind of growing it out a little bit, kind of going for a new look. You inspire me, Kelly, if you could
like
grow
it.
Out your hair. Thank you.
Yeah.
Got a little dip going down here. So. We give fashion tips here too, Melanie.
So I see.
Kelly and our
that's what I was saying earlier. Like, I look like I don't pay any attention to my looks, but this is a very careful and cultivated.
Well, in our last episode, you were like a cool hipster, cool with your plaid shirt. And you had a purple beanie on as well. Lavender beanie with a peace sign on it as well. So he came rolling in here all hipsterish. So,
yeah. The funny thing is, just I think I wore that same outfit in like 1995.
I was about to say, giving Pearl all Jam the 90s.
Exactly.
It was a good time.
It was a great time, and there are very few photographs.
That's probably to your blessing.
One thing I do want to make time to talk about, and I think this will probably lead us back to spirituality, is we haven't really talked about your work.
Okay. You know,
yet. And one of the things that is one of our themes this season on the show is talking about words into action.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, and particularly about like spiritual and religious organizations, about like what kind of the problems are. We talk about some of the spiritual needs that people have, and really just kind of even some of the needs for social justice and equality and inclusion in society. And this season, we've really been talking about like, well, what do we do then? Like, how do we put these actions into words? So that is probably a good segue just to talk a little bit about what it is that you're doing now. Like, what are some of the things that your company does and what's some of the work you're doing in the community?
So I want to start by saying that I count myself as probably the luckiest person I know, because I get to make my living by doing things that I really love and believe in and that I'm really passionate about. My company is at this point 5 years old, and I spent many years, as Kelly said, as an educator, at the public school K-12 level, and then at the college level. And I did a lot of work for 18 years with communities, of folks who had disabilities, students with disabilities, outreach to organizations and providing educational programming and sometimes education for folks who are providing services for people with disabilities. So my company started really with more of an emphasis on that disability justice and that accessibility piece. And then that it grew and it blossomed from there to, you know, inclusion of anti-racist practice, which is really our emphases are disability justice and anti-racism. We also, though, do work around LGBTQ+ justice. We've not done much around religious justice, but that's something that we're very invested in as well. So the bulk of what my company does is provide organizations, and typically they are for-profit, nonprofit, churches, I also have worked with some governmental entities in developing accessible, diverse, inclusive, and anti-racist practices in their organizations. Mm-hmm. So it usually begins with a needs assessment, you know, going out, talking to whoever the people are they're serving and members of the organization to determine what the strengths are and where the work needs to be done. From there, developing a diversity, equity, and inclusion strategic plan. You could also include accessibility and belonging to that. I always struggle with whether to go with DEI or DEIAB because the more letters you have, the more you lose people and confuse people. Yeah. But the next step is the strategic plan and then the implementation of that plan, which usually includes a good deal of education. And that's where that education background comes back in. So trainings, professional development, et cetera. I really love this work. The other piece of what we do is we do work with a couple of different providers of services. One is a school, one is a nonprofit for that are designed specifically for communities of people with specific disabilities. One is a school for students who have emotional and behavioral disabilities. One is Autism Society of Maryland, which provides supports. And a lot of what we're helping with is a lot of now workforce development, preparation and support for individuals with autism who are entering the workforce. So everything that we do as an as a company, it's a for-profit company, but everything that we do as a company is dedicated to helping marginalized communities to gain equity. Whether that begins with helping white-led organizations to understand why anti-racism works for them as well. I mean, that's a big shift in thinking for a lot of organizations. Anti-racism isn't about helping the poor people of color. Anti-racism is about understanding why we all are, it's going back to interconnectivity, why we all are interconnected and no one is at the center of that. And it's becoming harder and harder for organizations with socially focused missions to be, you know, predominantly white in this day and age. Mm-hmm. You have to know how to not only work with people of other cultures, but you have to understand how those cultures make your organization stronger, whether it means if your mission is to reach more people through an educational purpose, well, then you need to understand those communities you want to work with as education partners. And it needs to not be top down. We're here to educate you. It's also, you know, it has to be more inclusive than that. If your organization's mission is, you know, even climate based or technology based, well, you know, the global South is emerging in terms of tech. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about climate, culture and race, it plays a major part in who is being most affected even now by climate change. So my work, what I see as being my work from now until hopefully a retirement one day is to try to earn my living in this world by also helping people to better understand how a new America needs to look. It's not even about should look, has to look going forward.
Yeah, it's amazing. There are areas that I think people don't even think of that anti-racism needs to have a presence. I know a lot of the marketing work that I do is in healthcare, and even thinking about like when new drugs are developed, who's in the clinical trials, you know, and then also from treatment, you know, just, you know, there are plenty of studies that show that people of color have very different experience at the doctor than white people do.
Vastly
and
different.
Even it's something as simple as like my back hurts, that can, those are two entirely different experiences.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's an area where there's, where equity is definitely needed. Even, you know, there's even some assessments for disease. You talk about like autism, that the assessments for autism were largely developed using data from middle class white boys. And so all these, you know, and what that means is that that girls, people of color, people of different socioeconomic classes get diagnosed a lot later. So there's a lot of different areas where
Black women have vastly higher rates of maternal issues in pregnancy, dying during pregnancy or childbirth, than women of any other group in this country. And it's across socioeconomic lines. It's not just Black women living in poverty. It's Black women in general. And it's not true in Africa. And it's not true in a lot of the Caribbean. It's true in the United States. And that's that's an issue. And, you know, there's the whole myth of pain threshold, like you were saying about going in and saying my back hurts. You know, there is a long held myth in the medical industry that Black people tolerate pain better or differently or have a different threshold for pain than white people do, that our skin is thicker. And so, you know, that also goes into treatment. And there's a study that came out last year that said that Black children under the care of white pediatricians die at a much higher rate than Black children who are being served by Black pediatricians. But it's not the same in reverse. White infants or white babies have a just an equal amount of equal rate of survival, no matter who their pediatrician is. But so there's a lot in terms of medicine, and equity where we need to move along. In terms of science and equity, I presented recently to a group of folks from the tech industry, and they were wonderful and just really open to what I had to say, you know, not defensive or combative. But I was just shocked by the dearth of knowledge when I talked about the fact that people of darker skin, people with more melanin, have a harder time using things like those automatic faucets in public bathrooms or the automatic paper towel dispensers, because they don't pick up on people who are developing the technology often don't look like us. Or that, you know, Black women are the group right now. I believe this is true, that Black women are the group in the country right now who are most likely to be misidentified by facial recognition software. And there was a woman in the Midwest recently who went to jail because of being misidentified. She was pregnant at the time, being misidentified by facial recognition software. So, yeah, there are so many facets of life. There, these equity issues exist. And yeah, it's a little relentless. I mean, that's part of my job, is to be able to communicate these things and to begin to affect change in a way that does not cause my clients to just give up because the scope of it can be really daunting. Mm-hmm. But it's incremental change sometimes. I mean, I'd like things to be rapid, but sometimes it's about doing things incrementally because there's just so much work to be done.
Thank you for all of that and enlightening me and our listeners about the work you do. And you said something that resonates strongly, in that you have found a work that also fits your call and how you love that, and that you indeed are fortunate, because unfortunately not everybody has that ability to do what they love. But carrying that message out into the world is a must. As you said, it's not a want, it's a need. And it can be daunting. In fact, yes, all of those examples you described are so, they're just, I've heard the phrase, maybe I'm sure you're familiar with it, about microaggressions.
Yes.
And it feels like that. It's just, it's always like there's so much to it. It's not big things, but it's just the little things, but those add up. And it happens to, you know, to my community as a queer community, you know, and certainly people that are, you know, anything but this, you know, what we see as the white person that's used as the example within our culture that fits whatever norm that we have set up around that. And yet it totally denies the existence of everybody else out of that. And that dignity only will come for all of us mm-hmm. when we all have our dignity. It's not, as you said, no one's in the center of this. We all must all join into this deep interconnection. And unfortunately, in our society right now, it seems like it's getting worse, not better in mm-hmm. some ways. But yet there are people like you that are out there fighting for that.
Thank
you. So that's my thought on that. I wanted to ask you specifically about this pushback about the letters DEI that have recently happened. This is crazy. So what's your thoughts on this? Why is this happening?
Now, are you talking pushback on the entire movement?
Yeah, you know
of
how people get really upset about that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So there are folks that say this is woke and all. Yeah.
You just answered your own question because they think it's wokeism. And we live in this moment we live in a moment in this country. And unfortunately, the more I read in international news, it seems it's not just this country, which is more frightening than I can deal with on a daily basis. So I really just try to focus on what's happening in my own country because that's where I feel like I have the most control. But yes, I definitely am seeing this pushback. The DEI director, I believe, for Johns Hopkins University here in Baltimore, where I live, was just fired recently in the last week or so because she talked about privilege and and some big names, including Donald Trump, got wind of it and made a fuss. And she's been relieved of her duties for talking about privilege. So, yes, there is a huge backlash in certain, we'll say segments of our population. I don't think it's as, I don't think it's as big as we would think. Just like the MAGA movement. The MAGA movement includes a minority of people. They're a very vocal minority, and unfortunately, I think they vote more frequently and passionately, maybe than folks who are very much on the other end of the on the other side, but. If you look at their sheer numbers, there are not as many of them in numbers. And I think it's the same with the people who are pushing back on DEI. The problem is that the folks who are doing so tend to be very powerful. They tend to, they're working with political forces that, are looking to cherry pick the best possible cases to be able to challenge these things in courts of law, which is what we saw with affirmative action. Which, by the way, has overwhelmingly always benefited white women more than any other group, affirmative action. But, public perception is reality, right? And as I believe in my heart of hearts, and I have a long history of getting it wrong when it comes to America, I thought 9/11 was going to usher in an era of diplomacy because we were going to understand how it is for other people. I thought the pandemic was going to make us all bind together and saying that, this late stage capitalism is killing us. None of those things happened. The opposite happened in both situations. Yep. So I hope I'm not 3 for 3, but I really do believe that this pushback is the last gasp of a very few, increasingly few people who just have this mindset that America is about privilege for dominant cultures. So if I am a white person, the police are supposed to be here to protect me and my neighborhood. Of course they are. And if I am a straight person, why should I have to, make a cake for your wedding because I only make cakes for straight people. And if I am, just going on and on. If I'm a Christian, a Christian community, of course we don't want this Jewish family moving in. It's about that has been the mindset. The dominant culture wins has been the mindset in the United States for as long as there's been one, basically. And the Civil Rights Act of 1965, which is my favorite thing that's ever happened in this country, practically, or maybe even literally, I have to really think about that, not only gave me, all the rights that come with being an American citizen, it also opened the door for immigration to happen for Black and brown people and Asian people increasingly as well. So we saw more folks coming from the global South, and we saw more folks coming from Asia. We saw more folks coming from Latin America. And these folks who are holding up this whole this isn't what America looks like. And immigrants are poisoning the bloodstream of America. And, you know, and women, you know, need to know their place.
Theory.
And the great replacement theory, all of those things. They're coming from people who grew up in an America where everybody looked like them on the television, in newspapers, in magazines, in the movies. Everywhere they turned, their own whiteness was reflected back to them. All their leaders were white. There was no reflection of anyone else. That's the world they grew up in. And the world we're living in now scares the living hell out of them. It doesn't look like anything they've seen before. Whereas as a Gen Xer, you know, we were the first generation, and we didn't get it right. I'll tell you that as a Black girl growing up in the 80s. But at least we were the first generation where people recognized and that, oh, there are other people here. And we saw each other. Oh, there are people in my, maybe not in my class, depending on where you live in the country, there may be people in your class who look differently than you. But you turn on the TV and you actually saw people who looked different than you did in movies, in magazines, et cetera. The millennials don't know anything else. That's all they've ever seen. And
millennials and the Zoomers.
And the Zoomers,
The Zoomers, just they don't even put up with our bullshit.
My teenager thinks that my efforts at political correctness are funny.
Oh, mine too.
Like they're like so far beyond it.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, don't use that term. And they're like, well, my friends think that's, you know, that, and they have like such a diverse group of friends. I think like my kind of legalism about political correctness, but you know, I'm like, no, we got to call everybody by the right names. Don't use that word. And
there's hope in those
youngsters.
They're
like living on a different plane.
I can't wait to see what's going to happen when they're like in their 30s and 40s. Oh gosh, I hope to still be here. When they're in their 30s and 40s and they're running things, if we still have an earth that we can live on that's inhabitable by us,
right?
I think that these young people have it right.
I do too. They have a different enthusiasm and a worldview that none of us have had. And of course, I've gotten this conversation with family as well. They're like, well, yeah, you know, they're not the first ones. There was the 60s. I'm like, yes, I get that. You're talking about my folks, and I'm not picking on my parents particularly, but that generation, the late stage baby boomers, they were all woke in the 60s as well. But then they also got a hold of the money. You're like, yeah, this is pretty cool. Yeah. And they just gave up on all that, like the peace movements and everything else. And I would tell you, yes, we came in as Gen Xers, and I think we got a little bit better, but I really think the Zoomers are going to show us how you sustain doing radical change. I really believe that they are
100%.
The ones. Let us hope they are the ones. Yes, yes. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think there was, at least for me, I mean, coming from a very white community in Indiana, then moving to Baltimore, which is a majority of Black, and learning a whole lot about culture, and then going to very like politically correct liberal college.
Yes, you were.
That my efforts then were about colorblindness, were it was that whole thing. And it was, you know, and I've been taught, you know, like after the civil rights movement, everybody's equal now, everybody's got the same opportunities. And then it took a real education after that for me to realize like the experiences of different people are still very different. You can't just ignore that fact. And I think that's one of the things that's really, really needs to get unpacked right now. And I think that's part, an essential part, or at least it's been an essential part of the education for me around anti-racism is acknowledging like everybody's experience is still different and there's still a lot of inequity.
Oh my God. Yes.
And I see it. I see whole communities that are like, why does everything have to be about race? Or why does everything have to be about, you know, you can dress up like a girl, but I don't have to be part of it. You know,
and
to me, my question is like, well, why wouldn't you though?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway,
I was in a thread on Facebook about a week ago that had to do with Baltimore and its history of housing segregation. And someone said something about, you know, well, we just want to live in peace. And another person said, well, we'll never live in peace as long as the race hustlers like Jesse Jackson and Reverend Sharpton.
Al Sharpton.
Al Sharpton yeah. are still around. Da, da, da. And, you know, and my comment to him was, but peace for whom? You know, I mean, so when mm-hmm. people say, you know, why are we talking about race so much? Why do we have to talk about race?
Because, yeah, why do we have to do that?
You know, I'm going to say something. I try to be very careful about talking about cultures that I am a dominant culture, the white culture. And if you're a person of color in this country, you know white culture in and out. There's no way not to. In order to survive, you have to. If you have media, you are fully entrenched in white culture. You know everything about white culture. So I don't know a lot about Jewish culture, and I try not to speak too much about that. But I will say this. I had a revelation in the last week in talking about the Middle Passage with a friend. And my daughter is taking a course right now in college where she's been dropping this knowledge on me. So the beautiful thing when your kids are in college, you learn so much. And she was telling me, I don't know if my numbers are right because I don't remember numbers well, but I believe what she said was that about a third of the continent of Africa basically just was gone after the transatlantic slave trade. And if you look mm-hmm. at the number of Africans who landed in the US and the Caribbean, it couldn't possibly be that many people as Africa lost, which tells you what happened on that voyage. That tells you mm-hmm, how mm-hmm. many millions of Africans died
millions.
During
yes.
that voyage.
Yes.
And the only, yeah. As Black people, when we tell that story, especially when we're telling the story to other cultures, the only thing that we have that we can use to put it into sort of a context or to show the scope of it is to compare it to the Holocaust. And that bugs mm-hmm, me on mm-hmm. many levels. One, because I shouldn't have to use mm-hmm. someone else's horrific tragedy to make someone have sympathy for my horrific tragedy. But the
well said.
Other part of that, though, is I feel it then contributes to what, you know, I and many people call like the oppression Olympics. You know, well, which group has had it worse,
right.
which does no one any good
That's
ever.
Right.
But
zero contrast and comparison never works well.
Never works well. But as I've been thinking more and more about that and how angry that makes me that I have that this atrocity cannot stand on its own. It has to be compared to someone else's. And I thought, well, why is that? And the reason is because after World War II, pretty much the entire globe came together and agreed that something truly horrific had happened. And these people had been the victims of an enormous injustice, and apologies were made, and you know the tragedies were acknowledged, and the wrongness was acknowledged, and there was sort of a maybe spoken, maybe unspoken kind of global agreement. We don't want to see this happen again. This is not something that's good. We should probably work towards not having things like this happen again. We have never received that. The indigenous Americans
no, you haven't.
Have never received
no.
that. Latino
no,
Americans
have, not.
Have never received that. And that is, so when I hear people say, why do we have to talk about race? Why do people of color always want to talk about race? When I say you, I'm talking about the white dominant culture in this country, mm-hmm. would just ignore the history and the magnitude of it. And say, look, our bad, let's try to make things better. Honest to
Agreed.
God, all we're really looking for, you know, acknowledge
Amen, Melanie.
It and do better.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and you thank you for that because I'm so glad you say that. And it is, we will not make progress until we recognize and acknowledge that for ourselves. I remember some time ago and having a conversation with a friend that both Kelly and I know through our congregation in New York City. And, you know, he's of color as well. And it's basically the shifting of perspective. A couple of things we've discussed. First of all, color blindness. So that is a cop-out when you think about when you say that. It's
right.
like, it, not a cop-out. I don't mean that in a mean way. It was just like, I say that is now because I used to say that, well, I'm colorblind. I was like, no, because then that means I don't understand it. to his point, though, he's like, it's not our job as Black folks to teach white folks on what our journey's been like. Mm-hmm. You guys need to do this yourselves. This is your work as right.
Like, racism itself is a white problem. Yeah. Like, that's the we should be talking about it amongst ourselves.
We need to be talking about this. Yes. And claiming ownership and understanding, you know, the damage that is done and how this is our work and how this impacts all of us. And I must say one other thing. You mentioned privilege and the fact, getting back to the DEI officer of Johns Hopkins who got fired over that. That just pissed me off. I mean, I get feisty about this. Like, you're kidding me? She used a word that was too far, too triggering, and they pushed her out over that. You're kidding me. Are we that sensitive? Well, clearly we must be to the power structure. Because if you say she dare use that word, I'm like, that's exactly what it is. It's called white privilege. And it's not going to go away. So.
Yeah. And by the way, I wanted to tie this back because as we're talking about this whole piece, what we're all talking about, the acknowledgement of the wrongs that have been done, and then the agreement to do better. What is more based in the teachings of Christ than that? Ask for
great
forgiveness.
Great way of bringing it home.
And then
somebody was talking the other day about, we're doing a study series during Lent at my church. And we were talking about different people. And we were talking about racism. We were talking about culturalism. And one of the guys there who's a doctor, he said, menstruating women. And everybody was like,
got my attention.
You know, I'm sitting, I'm sitting with, you know, a bunch of Episcopals after church, like we're eating our cookies or whatever. Like, what? And he was like, in the culture at the time in first century Palestine, in the Jewish culture where Jesus was teaching, that a woman who was menstruating was considered unclean.
Correct.
And men were not able to, you know, they were not allowed to be in the same place with them. They had, you know, even now.
They still do this.
There are cultures that have beds that are, you know, it's not a queen bed. It's actually a twin bed with like a piece in the middle that you can remove and pull the beds apart. And he talked about the story of why that's significant is that there was a woman who was hemorrhaging, who continued to have her period for days and days and days and days in the Bible. And, you know, the King James kind of cleans it up as like the woman with the issue of blood.
Of course.
But this was a woman who someone, you know, like a teacher like Jesus would not typically be hanging out with. And she was looking for him in the crowd and actually touched his garment to get healed. And he was like, who touched me? And if I remember the story correctly, she was also Syrophoenician, which was culturally also someone that he wasn't supposed to be associating. But he was like, you are healed right now because of your faith. It like looked at her directly, addressed her as an equal, and gave her the credit for doing it. It wasn't like, I'm healing you because of your faith. He was like, you're healed because of your faith. And we're all sitting there looking at this guy telling this story. Like, there are all these little moments in the Jesus story that, looking at it from our cultural lens, we're not necessarily seeing how big those were.
Agreed.
So true. So true.
Another piece of...
He was doing it all over the place.
Jesus was basically like walking DEI. I'm going to say that.
For real.
And, you know, there's a sort of this whole concept that if you, I call it the Jesus theory. I don't think anyone, I think that's just me. I call it the Jesus theory, but there's this whole concept, right, in this work that what you do, accommodations, whether it's accommodations for people with disabilities, whether it is, equity work for women or for people of color, what you do that helps the most marginalized groups among us ends up helping everyone else. You know, it's like those breaks in the sidewalk for wheelchairs make it easier for baby strollers. It makes it easier for people in big cities if you're pushing a grocery cart from, you know, the grocery store home. If you, you know, the Black Panthers started the, you know, free breakfast program for kids before school because there were poor kids living in impoverished communities and they were going to school not fed in the morning. That ended up becoming a school lunch, a school federal breakfast program that's available to kids all over the country of all races and depending on your school district, all socioeconomic levels as well. The solutions that we come up with for the most marginalized people in our society usually end up being beneficial in some ways to everybody in our society. So I call it the Jesus theory. Because it's what Jesus said, what you do for the least of us, right? What you do for the least of me, someone may want to correct the quote. The quote may be wrong, but, you know, what you do for the least of me, you do for me. What you do for the least of you, you do for me.
What you do for the least of these, you also do for
there
me.
It is. That's how he goes. There it is.
You know, and that.
Does that make sense? I'm not making sense, but I just feel it's basically.
Oh, you're making total sense. Okay, it's like you need to trademark that if that's trademarkable.
Oh, thank you.
I love that. The Jesus theory.
And this
what you do for the least of us, you do for all of us.
And this is why I'm so baffled, though, by so many of the interpretations of Jesus as a being, but also the words of Jesus I just don't understand how it's been twisted into what it is, because everything I've ever known is that this is who Jesus is.
So as we're wrapping this up, and what a beautiful conversation, keeping the theme of exploring faith outside of the boxes, which is exactly what you do. To answer your question there, I would say this is what happens with flawed theology and interpretations and rationalization and justification and misinterpretation of scripture and pulling from all of the different books to then assemble your point of view that you want to justify why this is, you know, the stance and what it is to be Christian. And yet we keep denying the basic Jesus teachings, right? If we stuck to just the red letter part of the Bible, we would do a lot better for ourselves if we could just do that. Mm-hmm, and what you're talking about is exactly that. If we carried out and listened to the actions of this dude who lived 2,000 years ago, you know, as I often say, even if you're not a Christian, even if you're not one that believes in the resurrection and the holiness that goes with that, fine, I don't care. Just go with the stories. We would be a better off world if we did that.
Yep.
So, I don't think I could wrap it up any better than that. Melanie, it has been great catching up with you. And I look forward to continuing our conversations on Facebook. And if people who are listening to us are interested in contacting you about the work that you do, getting a consultation with your company, how do they find you?
The best possible contact would be through email, Melanie Hood Wilson and Associates, all one word, @gmail.com, which you can also find on my website, MelanieHoodWilsonAndAssociates.com.
Awesome. Awesome. And we'll put those in the notes for the podcast as well. So people can click on them there.
And thank you for having me today. This has been wonderful. This has been a wonderful use of my afternoon. And thank you so much.
Oh, right on.
Awesome. Well, it's been great. It's been great hanging out with you. And we will keep in touch. Sounds like we've got a lot more to talk about. Anytime you want to come back, let us know.
Yep.
Thank you. Love to.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Radical Love Live, co-hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson. All rights reserved. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, and other popular podcast platforms. Go to RadicalLoveLive.com to learn more about us, watch recordings of our live events, and listen to our podcast. We also invite you to check out what Kelly and Mark are doing by going to our websites. Find Kelly at KellyWilson.com and Mark at MarkDilcom.com. This is Radical Love Live, where we explore faith outside the boxes.